Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 17th of September. Before we get rolling on this very good first hour, I want to thank everybody who attended our healthcare forum yesterday at the Frederick Clinical Cancer Center. It was a very good crowd. Thanks to all of the panelists who were superb, the people at Frederick for putting this together and giving us that space, and all the people here who worked to make the broadcast possible. We will continue our series of programs on healthcare reform. So thanks so much to all of you for attending and being a part of what I thought was a significant addition to the discussion about healthcare reform. All right, I'm so glad these guys wrote this article in October's Vanity Fair. We are happy to welcome James Steele and Donald Bartlett with us. They have been here many times before, but they have, you know, we've been asking this question. I love these guys because you've been asking this question and then they got the answer to it. What happened to that TARP money? Last October, Congress, they write in their recent article, passed the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, putting $700 billion into the hands of the Treasury Department to bail out the nation's banks at a moment of vanishing credit and peak financial panic. Treasury poured over the next 3 months $239 billion in 296 of the nation's 8,000 banks. It went to big banks, to small banks, those who really wanted the money, and those who didn't want the money but it had been ordered by the Treasury to take the money. Once the money left the building, the government lost all track of it. The Treasury Department knew where it had sent the money, but nothing about what was done with it. Did it aid the recovery? Was it spent for the purposes Congress intended? Did it save banks from collapse? Paulson's Treasury Department had no idea and didn't seem to care. They never required the banks to explain what they did with this unprecedented infusion of capital. James Steele and Donald Bartlett are our guests this hour. Their article is Good Billions After Bad, The Bailout Nine in October's Vanity Fair. They have been working together since 1971, and they have been called the best team in the history of investigative reporting. They have done all kinds of work. They worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer for a number of years, then at Time Magazine, and now at Vanity Fair since 2006. They have received two Pulitzer Prizes for newspaper reporting and two National Magazine Awards for magazine work. They've written seven books. One of their books, recent one, actually. We should talk to them again about this book. We should do that. We'll try to book them down the road here, this marvelous book on healthcare in this country. All right, so enough of all the intros, but these guys are good, rest assured. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, wpr.org, for you to join our conversation. And we welcome James. Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Long time no talk. Pleasure to have
you. Wonderful to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure, you and your audience.
Yeah, you're a great pleasure as well. Donald, good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's just always a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, great to have you here. Thank God you guys wrote this article. This is one of these questions that I've been thinking about, and nobody has been able to come up with an answer. It's a difficult question, but I can't believe the fact that we don't really know where this money went, or in some cases, we know it went to questionable ends.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of the things that amazed us when we got into this. The complexity of this, there were certain demanding things about tracing this money, because what happened when this, after TARP, the Troubled Assets Program, was adopted by Congress, the initial idea was supposedly it was going to take care of these toxic assets that many banks had, the mortgages that were no good and so forth, the investments and so on down the line. But then Treasury and Paulson changed course right away, and they decided, well, what we need to do, what they needed to do, was get this money into the system. So to get it to, quote, healthy banks, which would then lend and sort of unfreeze the economy and so forth. That was the general idea. But when we started getting into this, we found out there's no rhyme or reason to this. There's absolutely, for all this announced plan, the execution followed none of that. Some of the banks that got it were in trouble. Others weren't in trouble, didn't even want the money, as you pointed out a couple of minutes ago. It just seemed to be they were just flushing money into the system, saying, okay, let's see if this works. And as Elizabeth Warren, who's headed the Congressional Oversight Panel, put it in some testimony before Congress, she said there isn't a bank in the country that would loan money, would send money out under these conditions. But because it was taxpayer money and they thought they had a crisis on their hands, and they simply didn't care.
Yeah. They sure didn't. Tell me about this meeting that took place. They got the money. Paulson calls into a room, nine banks. They're not sure why they're there. And essentially they're told, here's what we're doing.
Wouldn't you have liked to have been, you would really like to have been a fly on the wall in that meeting. But what happened was, back in October 2008, Paulson, the night before, calls these nine banks, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch at the time, Goldman Sachs, et cetera, and says, you come to Treasury tomorrow afternoon for a meeting. And none of them really knew what this was about. But when they got there, he puts before them one piece of paper, which is called his talking points memo. And basically, it says they're going to announce this program the next day to buy stock in banks around the country. And you fellas, you nine, we're going to buy stock in your banks, basically whether you like it or not. Some of the bankers even expressed reservations like, well, my bank's okay, I don't really need this. And basically, Paulson threatened them. If you don't go along with this, your regulators are going to say your reserves are such that you're going to be required to put up this extra money anyway, so you might as well just sign here. The most amazing thing to us is any of us who've ever borrowed money for a house or anybody who's had to take out a student loan, everybody knows how voluminous the reporting requirements are for these things, right? Well, here, you know what it was for this? It was a one-page document, and all the bankers had to do was fill in how much money they wanted, whether it was $25 billion, $10 billion, $15 billion, sign their name and date the thing, and they got the money. Wouldn't you like to do a financial transaction like that someday?
And some of them were worried. They knew that they might be getting money, and they thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to be up all night and cramming for this because it usually would take 3 weeks to fill out all these forms. Not only one page, but as you say, a lot of it is blank space on the one page.
Exactly. So it further supports the idea that there really wasn't much of a design here. They were just throwing money out there on the wall and seeing if any of it stuck and got the economy going. But beyond that, they had no real follow-up. It was just literally flushing money into the system and hoping maybe it would do some good.
Mm-hmm. And Donald, there are a lot of troubling things, but we have this Office of Financial Stability to disperse this money, and there are quite a few conflicts of interest here because the guy who's picked to head this is a former Goldman Sachs banker.
Well, in some ways, this whole bailout experience really underscores why Goldman Sachs sometimes is referred to not in a very respective manner as Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs people were everywhere in this. Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs executive, was tapped to run AIG. And AIG, as it turns out, was the single biggest beneficiary of all of the TARP money. And it wasn't and isn't a bank at all. It was a giant insurance company, the world's largest. And it, in turn, took the money and distributed it to other banks for which there was little record at the time. They did finally release the identities. But what was interesting about most of the bailout money that AIG received went to banks in Europe, not in the U.S. Although they did give it to, they gave money also to U.S. banks. But two of the biggest beneficiaries of this money were a German bank, Deutsche Bank, and a French bank, Societe Generale. And to give you just some feeling for how little attention was paid to this, AIG gives almost $12 billion. Remember, this is U.S. taxpayer money to the French bank. Well, just a few months before, Societe Generale had reported what was generally regarded as one of the world's largest trading scandals in which a rogue trader lost more than $7 billion for the bank. So who are we making whole here? Are we really dealing with a financial crisis, or are we taking care of a French bank that, you know, was taken to the cleaners by one of its own people? And there's no sense of this at all. Deutsche Bank was no different. Deutsche Bank gets almost $12 billion from AIG. And the year before posted one of its largest losses ever in securities trading. But what does the U.S. taxpayer have to do with these banks? And why are they bailing them out? And when you think about this, the $239 billion that in the early months, that was the equivalent of every dollar in income tax paid by everyone who makes $75,000 a year or less in this country.
My goodness. My goodness. Did any of these banks, we heard reports, but nobody knew because we weren't getting, you know, big stimulus to the economy. There were questions about whether or not these banks were sitting on their money that they got from TARP. Were they?
Well, that's a good question. And some did. Some just put it in their vaults, in effect. Others used the money to buy other banks.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly the idea of this program, which was to free up credit and so forth. So many of them sat on it. Many of them bought other banks. Some continued to fund some questionable programs that had nothing to do with expanding credit. We talked about one out in Santa Barbara, a company that...
Oh, that one made me mad.
That finances these things called refund anticipation loans. These are very predatory loans given to the low-income people. When they fill out their tax return, the tax preparers tell them, look, if you want your return right away, you can just sign here and we'll give you the money today. And then the return comes basically to the tax preparer. Well, those instruments, those loans are financed by a handful of banks. One of them is the one out in Santa Barbara, which was a recipient of TARP funds. So to answer your question, once again, there was no rhyme or reason to this whole process. Many banks, I think the best evidence that many of these banks didn't need this money to begin with is that here you have just a few months later, many of them repaying these loans. And not loans, they're buying back their stocks. And the purpose of that was obviously some of them didn't like the executive compensation requirements of the TARP bill. But how, if they were in such bad shape, if they needed this, if this had some real function, how could all of them, just in the space of like 4, 5, 6 months, buy back their stocks so easily? And the answer to that is they didn't need this in the first place, and the whole thing didn't work.
How much of the money has gone back to the Treasury?
It's we looked at this about a week or two ago, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Don, but I think it's roughly around $75 billion has been bought back in stock. That may not include the interest payments that some have. So money has gone back. There's no doubt about that. The big unknown, though, is that many of these banks are not able to make their dividend payments to the Treasury because some of them are in a difficult situation, which again conflicts with what was allegedly the intention of this, which was to put this money in the hands of healthy banks. And people have said to us, well, guys, doesn't this mean... I mean, wasn't this a good program? As I read these stories about these banks failing out there, and wasn't this an effort? Well, that's not what this program is about. This was supposed to go to healthy banks. And the fact is we have in this country and have had for decades a program that has worked for a long time that takes care of failing banks, and that's called the FDIC.
Mm-hmm.
That's already in place. And if the FDIC runs into trouble taking care of banks, then that's another issue that you handle in another way. But you don't do it in this slapdash kind of fashion they did there. The precedent is set of just shelling out this much money with no accountability, with no attempt to find out where the money was going, is really a dangerous thing to have done. And we certainly hope we don't ever see anything like this again.
You can't, Kathleen, you can't emphasize this business with the FDIC too strongly. Both Jim and I over decades, actually, we've seen the FDIC up close, including some banks, a bank that failed in Philadelphia. And this organization has really worked. It's one of those government agencies that actually functions and functions very well. And it could have handled all of this quite nicely. It might have needed some help along the way, but it would have been far better than just throwing this money out the window.
So why was it, as you have said, carte blanche? If TARP had been a credit card, it would have been called carte blanche. Why? Why? What were the ties between the government and these industries? What were they really doing?
One of the things, and Jim kind of alluded to this, as you did as well, with banks paying back this money, not really needing it. And the best you can say is there's no question there was a crisis. I mean, that's indisputable. But there were probably only three or four big institutions that were at risk, one of which wasn't a bank at all, but AIG. Mm-hmm. And it's the American International Group, was the formal name. And you know, you had Bank of America, you had Citigroup, and one or two others, and that was it. The rest all could have been handled very nicely through the FDIC without throwing all this money out the window with no accountability. And the three, AIG and Citigroup and Bank of America, if need be, could have been handled quite nicely through bankruptcy court. Hmm. But the one thing you would not have wanted if you were on Wall Street and in government was to have this process opened up in bankruptcy court, because then it would have become clear where the money was going. For example, in all of these cases, we've heard so much about all these exotic credit instruments, credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations. This is where all the junk mortgages went. But what Berdanke and Geithner achieved by doing it this was keeping secret the ultimate beneficiaries, who were the people on the other side of these transactions. Mm-hmm. In other words, when AIG made a bet on one of its instruments that X dollars would be, something was going to happen in a given transaction, that party was never identified and still remained secret. But worse than that, they collected 100 cents on the dollar in their bets. And it's really important for people to understand these are so complex, these transactions, but they are nothing more than casino bets. For example, you could, it would be the equivalent of my looking at you and saying, God, you're a terrible driver. I'm going to buy an insurance policy on your car. Buying that policy and covering it, you have a wreck and I collect on your accident. I have no interest, no direct financial interest or economic interest at all in this transaction, but this is what these transactions allowed me to do. Wow. And these are the ones where not in the billions of dollars, but in the trillions of dollars. So all of these people were made whole. Had they gone to bankruptcy court, they would have been identified. The parties would have been identified. And I think, people would have taken to the streets.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. 800-486-8655. Donald Bartlett and James Steele have a piece well worth your attention. Good Billions After Bad, The Bailout 9 in October's Vanity Fair. And they are considered one of the best investigative reporting teams in American journalism. They've won Pulitzer Prizes for the newspaper work and the magazine equivalent for magazine reporting. They are now at Vanity Fair as contributing editors. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Jerry from Waterford. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on a couple things. I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but it's my understanding that this money was secured either through loan papers or through stock. And so it doesn't appear to me like it was just handed out in a willy-nilly fashion. You know, it was a secured, it wasn't a grant like Acorn got, for example. It was actually a secured loan of some sort. And the other thing that I understand is that they wanted all the banks to take this money because they did not want to single out a particular bank, because if they did, that might have caused a run on that bank. And so the government wanted to avert that, and that's the reason that they had it as widespread as what they did. And those are basically my comments.
All right. Thank you, Jerry.
Very good questions. And, Jerry, in terms of the security, yes, Treasury bought stock in these banks and gave the banks money in exchange for that stock. And the stock was to pay dividends and so forth. That is true. However, still, this was taxpayer money. It's not just like a private investor out there. You're putting out billions of dollars, and taxpayers have a right to know where that goes. And it's not just us raising this point. The Government Accountability Office, which has been around a long time, which is widely believed to be quite nonpartisan, even at the end of the Bush administration, was absolutely astonished that within Treasury, once these shares were purchased in some of these banks, that there was absolutely no follow-up to see whether or not the goals of the legislation that Congress had passed were in any way being met. And they continued to press Treasury on that. And GAO itself was quite astonished that the banks were actually even refusing, I mean, the Treasury was even refusing to ask the banks what they were doing with this money and whether the purposes of the legislation were being fulfilled. So the point we tried to make earlier about the kind of precedent this established, we think it's quite dangerous when you throw out that kind of money and you have no idea whether or not the goals of the legislation are being met.
The other aspect of this, which to us is almost equally important, is simple equity. You have a situation in which millions and millions and millions of people are losing their homes, in part as a result of these financial transactions, and they get little or no assistance whatsoever, and yet their tax money, taxpayer money, is used to help bail out the Wall Street people. It's just a double standard. One rule for banks and bankers and Wall Street, and another rule for ordinary working people.
Mm-hmm.
And you really saw a lot of this at play with the bailout of General Motors, in which nobody wanted to be connected, wanted to pour government money into General Motors, and that's understandable. But at the same time, there was very little similar response to the idea of putting all this money in the banks, including the foreign banks.
And what about they wanted to spread it around to keep there from being a run on those that were singled out?
We have read this before, and you know, the fact of the matter is, though, yes, they spread it around, but it's our opinion, it's more what Don talked about earlier. It was to create the notion or to suggest that this was a system-wide problem. The fact of the matter is, in those first 3 months where the vast bulk of the TARP money went out, it went to 296 banks, and there are 8,000 banks in this country.
You know, 3% of the banks.
You're still talking now they're big banks, some of them. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's still a small number of banks per se. So we don't think that argument really holds, because if a bank fails there or is about to fail, there are ways to deal with that. Like we mentioned earlier, the FDIC. The fact that they sent this money out system wide, you could almost argue had the opposite effect, which was to create the notion that we had a system-wide problem here, and it was only Treasury coming to this rescue that staved off this particular kind of ruin. The fact is, right after that happened, the stock market continued to swoon for a long period of time. So you can argue that maybe that didn't work so well after all.
Mm-hmm. We go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Thank you very much for your program and your guests. Could I ask two questions which I think are related, and I'm not quite sure that I can pose them correctly. But isn't there something extremely strange when an investment bank, an institution like Goldman Sachs, gets itself into trouble with what are essentially unregulated and very poorly scrutinized activities, and then it asks to become a bank so that it's treated as a bank to be bailed out. And that's extremely strange. And doesn't seem to be generally commented on.
You put your finger on it, Frank. It's not strange at all.
And the second thing is, how is it that the systemic problems are getting worse? I understand that banks that serve the social function of loaning to the real economy have their loan books deteriorating. And the Financial Times has said that the provision of liquidity to the real economy is not occurring. It's what the liquidity that has been provided has bailed out these major financial institutions. But we don't have an operating banking system that's providing the necessary money to Main Street. So we're going to have a long chronic depression, according to the Financial Times.
Thank you. That's a really good point. And your observation about Goldman Sachs all of a sudden becoming a commercial bank, that was done to help bail out Goldman Sachs. But the more intriguing question to us is this. Much has been made over the triggering mechanism for all this was Lehman Brothers going into bankruptcy. And this is always presented as though this was a great shock to Bernanke and Geithner. And such could not have been the case. Because one of the things Lehman Brothers asked for was to be made a commercial bank, just like Goldman Sachs. And Treasury and the Fed said absolutely not. Now, that would be an interesting question for someone to pursue. Why was the U.S. government involved in designating one financial institution to survive and another one to go down the tubes?
Mm-hmm. What about the money that went? We've had some stories about this, and you cite some of them in the article, the money that was spent by Northern Trust Company of Chicago. They cater to wealthy clients. They sponsor the Northern Trust Open. They fly in those wealthy clients from around the country as part of TARP money?
Absolutely. Northern Trust has been in Chicago for, I guess, roughly 100 years now or thereabouts. And it's made no bones of the fact, and at the very beginning of its existence, that it was catering to very wealthy people. In the beginning, it was the rich in Chicago, and now it's the rich anywhere. And even on their webpage, they make it very clear that it's folks in the range of assets of $200 million and above. In fact, I think $200 million is the bottom, the cutoff point. So many institutions that got TARP money continued to do business as usual, to fly executives to conferences in Hawaii and things of that sort. Northern Trust sponsored one of the more famous golf tournaments in the country, the one at Riviera in February in Los Angeles. It's one of the most famous tournaments in the PGA Tour. And they flew in Sheryl Crow, Earth, Wind, and Fire, all their leading corporate clients to mingle with both golfers and the glitterati. And Northern Trust is one of those that, interestingly enough, only about 3 or 4 months after that, I believe, then paid back that loan. But again, it gets to the heart that there were no controls on this money once it left Treasury. Treasury bought this stock in these banks, gave them the money, and then that was it. There was no follow-up. They did not care. The money was out in the system, supposedly doing good. It's hard to imagine how that did much to stimulate the American economy.
Right. Let's go to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I have a comment and a question. My comment is, it seems like probably this whole problem is created by the simple fact that we have a revolving door. This is the same people who are on both sides and
right,
basically helping each other out. And my question is, and I know the answer to it, but I'll pose it anyway. Is there anybody going to go to jail for this?
Well, you know the answer to that. Of course not. Nobody goes to jail for this sort of thing. This is the old boys network at work. And neither Bernanke nor Geithner is going to touch that. And here's the other weakness of this system. Here you have a Geithner as Treasury Secretary, and the guy who didn't pay the taxes he owed. So he's perfectly comfortable with people who operate like this. I mean, it's just, it really raises serious questions about ethical accountability, which, as you observed, there really isn't any.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Fred is next. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Couple of questions. First of all, I wondered if TARP was just basically a knee-jerk reaction, and was it based not so much on banks failing, but no loans being made. Second of all, the financial crisis appears to be over. I think what's important now is for Obama to get through a bill on banking regulations to enforce, clean up some of this. The other thing is, it's a little bit different, but like on the stimulus money that Obama is putting out there, I haven't seen what the latest percentage of what's been paid out is, but I just wonder if Bernanke's true and the recession's over, why doesn't Obama just say, I'm going to end the payout of the stimulus money and save all those billions of dollars? And to me, it would be a great political achievement on his part to do something like that rather than just continue to pay out the stimulus money if the economy is indeed recovering.
Thank you, Fred.
We'll come back and visit with you another time on the stimulus, perhaps. But on the first part of this, Fred, on the knee-jerk, it's interesting you use that term because we actually raise the question, the story, toward the end, like, what was this thing all about? Mm-hmm. Was it a case of panic? Was this thing well thought out, but they're not telling us what the plan really was? There's no doubt. Paulson went to Congress back in September 2008, basically put a gun to their head and said, look, our entire economy, the world's going to collapse. It's going to be smoke and ruins unless you pass this bill. And Congress, you can sort of understand how they would be a little scared about this. And they were told right away, you've got to do this. I mean, nobody wants the blood of the entire American economy on their hands. So there's no doubt there was a lot of scare tactics involved and a lot of threats and a lot of suggestions of Armageddon unless you do this. So that's true. But then the minute this was passed, which was supposedly to help banks that had all of these bad assets, then he switches gears because there's a credit freeze. We're going to pump money into the system in hopes banks will continue to loan again. One banker I talked to, this was off the record, but he said he actually happened to be a pretty healthy bank, and he said the problem with this whole idea of putting money out there and saying that will increase the credit is that I can have all the money in the world, but if people are scared, they don't want to borrow anything. So while there was a certain amount of credit freezing up, it is also true that a lot of people were scared to do anything at all. So it wasn't such a simple question of just pumping money out there and hoping that things would thaw. And in fact, it wasn't until really this year, and maybe even after the stimulus has passed and other measures were in place, that you saw the economy starting to gain its footing and stabilize it.
You know, Kathleen, in addition to the scare tactics that Jim mentioned, that were used during this whole thing, you had the government, both Bernanke and Geithner, really dealing in misinformation. One of the recurring themes was on these derivative contracts. And remember, these were in the trillions. We have to make sure these contracts, we have no choice but to provide the money to pay off the contracts because these are contracts after all. Well, that was nonsense. Anybody that spent any time in a courthouse knows that contracts are subject to litigation endlessly. Mm. And if you go into bankruptcy court, I guarantee you it doesn't matter what kind of a contract you have. It's going to be renegotiated. But by doing this like they did and keeping it out of bankruptcy, they guaranteed that select people at the top would collect 100 cents on the dollar on their contracts and would not have them renegotiated or forced to take a haircut, as always happens in bankruptcy court. All, you know, billions and billions and billions could have been saved by not honoring these contracts in a blanket fashion like this.
Wow. The best example, also some of these, and another phase of this, of some of these institutions that got money. I mean, this was to free up credit, supposedly. One of the big institutions that got a lot of money was Capital One. Most people think of Capital One as a credit card, but in fact, it is also a bank. They used it to buy another bank, which was in a certain amount of trouble. But then what did they do? They turned around and jacked up all their rates.
Mm.
Thereby, you would think, totally frustrating the idea about why you're pumping this money into the system, which was supposedly to free up credit and get the economy going again.
Right.
And, of course, they weren't the only ones. Almost all the big banks that had credit cards pretty much did the same thing. So, again, here you have this stated purpose, which was to try to free up credit, and yet the people getting this money then take the opposite tack.
Yeah. Well, I must ask you, you mentioned the Congressional Senate Committee, actually, that was charged with, you know, looking at the oversight panel, and Elizabeth Warren. A couple questions here. One is, did they get to the bottom of all of this? And the second thing is, you know, we're talking about trying to insure people who are uninsured in this country and come up with health care for everybody. And you would think, you mentioned somebody, why there wouldn't have been marching in the streets about this issue. Two questions. How great was the investigation of all of this? And number two, why weren't people marching in the streets? This is billions and billions of dollars, and people can't get health care.
Well, number one, it's probably going to take everybody a little while to find out where all of this money went. We actually made that point in the story. We just looked at those first 3 months where the bulk of the money went out and traced as much of it as we could. But both Elizabeth Warren and the Inspector General for TARP within Treasury and the Government Accountability Office, all three of them have been following various strands of the story. And in those early months, when almost all the money went out, they were terribly frustrated by the lack of cooperation from Treasury and so forth. I think some of that has changed a little bit this year, but the fact is that horse is long out of the barn, and it's very hard to trace that back to see where much of that went.
The other critical part of this is Elizabeth had no subpoena power. Absent subpoena power, you can be guaranteed that nothing is going to be learned.
Mm-hmm. The Inspector General for TARP, which was a special position created in this, I believe he does have more powers. As one of our folks told us, that he can carry a gun, he has a badge.
Oh, gee.
So he may ultimately get further down into where some of this went. And one of the things he's looking at are possible criminal violations in there. But so far to date, nothing has surfaced on that.
Part of the one of the real problems here is this is such a vast issue, and there is so much money involved. This would take, quite frankly, take an army. I mean, here you have AIG among the other institutions to which it distributed money, was it gave $5 billion, and this is U.S. taxpayer money.
Taxpayer, yeah.
$5 billion to UBS, the Swiss banking giant. Well, that's the same bank that is sitting on $18 billion in U.S. Cash put there in secret accounts by Americans looking to avoid income taxes.
Oh.
And so what does this say about the system that you give $5 billion in taxpayer dollars to a Swiss bank who's under investigation for the $18 billion it's sitting on in American taxpayer money? The American investments for which taxes have not been paid.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we're talking about The article written by James Steele and Donald Bartlett, it's Good Billions After Bad, the Bailout Nine in the October issue of Vanity Fair. And it's about the huge amount of money that was given out as the Bush administration entered its final months. The Treasury shoveled, as they say, more than $250 billion in TARP funds into the financial system without restrictions, accountability, or even common sense. And it looks at, and it's a hard story to get at because of the complexity and because of the worldwide nature of this, and how, and because there's not accountability for this money. Where did it go, and did it do the opposite of what was needed and what was needed? They are two of the best in investigative journalism, and we're taking more phone calls for them in a moment. 800-486-8655, or feel free to send an email if you want to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, Bruce from Milwaukee. Hello, Bruce.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm going to run out and buy this magazine. It's all my fears and apprehensions are being revealed for the truth. But two questions. One is, why don't you ever hear about the Reserve Management Fund, which closed? It was the it invented money market funds 4 years ago, and it was frozen last September and dissolved over the 4 months of this credit debacle. The second is, weren't foreign governments and foreign banks the owners of the CDOs and the credit default swaps and promised these huge interests on derivatives, and weren't they the ones who were going to sue the American government if they didn't make good on this?
Well, your point, that last point, is absolutely right. This is why AIG took the money and paid them off. But there are lawsuits every day, and it doesn't mean that somebody's going to win. And the government, you know, there are corporations which have reputations for never, ever conceding a lawsuit, and they will litigate it to their death. The government in this case rolled over and said, we can't risk being sued. We're going to just pay the money. The government should have taken a hardline stance and paid no one and then litigated it, because the odds of the of many of these things being litigated were really very remote. There would be too many embarrassing details over the exact nature of these transactions that would emerge in litigation that those parties would not want that information out there, which is why this is all secret today.
And why wasn't there, thanks, Bruce, for the call, you talk about this being one of the most questionable ventures that the U.S. government has ever pursued. Why wasn't there more congressional regulation, if there could have been, of all of this? We're talking massive, massive amounts of money here, our money, taxpayers' money. Why wasn't there congressional oversight of all of this?
Well, I think, they tried to do that through the Congressional Oversight Panel, and you couldn't have anybody much more aggressive in trying to get to the bottom of it than Elizabeth Warren, who Don and I know. But she was, again, stymied in part by the lack of subpoena power, and also by the total refusal of Treasury in the last days of the Bush administration to cooperate in any way, providing basic information about where money was going and what was happening in terms of dealing largely with the mortgage crisis out there. I mean, that was one of the principal reasons why that legislation was enacted. So what is amazing to us when we read this is just how the strength with which Treasury under Paulson and the Office of Financial Stability and really everybody at the highest levels just basically ignored congressional intent and went their own way. Perhaps you can say this is what you can do when you know you're in your last 2 or 3 months of office, and you know that by the time this whole thing passes by, you're going to be out somewhere else, out of office. I think any other administration that had done this during a term, where there was a long period of time, it would have been much more difficult. I mean, that's what made this financial crisis such an unusual event, that it came right in the midst of a presidential election, right at the end of a lame duck administration. So So I'm not saying he would have had more accountability at another time, but that almost assured that Treasury could be completely arrogant and ignore things. They really weren't much better after Obama came in. Geithner was not initially very cooperative with those congressional committees. That apparently has changed somewhat. So part of that's Treasury. Treasury is the most secretive of agencies in many ways. They take the position, we can't give you much information about banks, there'll be a run on the system. So the whole thing, they use that excuse as a reason why we're not told much of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because if more were revealed, it would lead to potential instability in the markets. It's a wonderful excuse that doesn't hold a lot of water, but they come back and they use that each time.
Yeah.
The other thing that occurred during this transition was, and this is one area where Paulson was very smart. Geithner was a party to all these transactions, and he signed off on them. And so you had the incoming administration going along with the outgoing administration from day one.
Geithner was in the meeting with the Big Nine.
Oh, my.
When he was then head of the New York Fed. So from day one, I mean, it's been almost a seamless transition.
Same players, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but the bulk of the money did go out before Obama came in. What's happened since then, and we didn't really get into this in the article, but what has happened since then is many, many more banks have gotten money, but the amounts have been very small. The vast bulk of the money went out by the time Obama took office.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. Let me put it this way. There's got to be a new version of the movie Dumb and Dumber coming out, and it'll be about Americans and what happens in the world of finances. 20 years ago, in 1989, 1992, there was $250 billion insurance deliverance of failed savings and loan associations.
Right.
Resolution Trust Company, there was a $1.5 billion Saudi cash infusion arranged by the New York Federal Reserve. I rescued the Mexican peso in Clinton's administration in 1994. That was life support, as Kevin Phillips has said in his book, for Wall Street investments in high-paying peso bonds. This game is so rigged that if it's not about the banking system, it's about our democracy and people getting really, really cynical about going to work every day, trying to get health insurance, trying to pay for their kids to get through college so they can do better. And they may, I said something ridiculous on this program a while back. I said they should have given all of the money to the mortgagees, the people holding the mortgages, and then said these checks issued by the government are only negotiable at the banks where your mortgage is held. Pay it off. The house is yours. People laughed at that and said, that's ridiculous. Congress would never do that.
It would have been cheaper, wouldn't it?
Yeah. What they did was they essentially screwed the American public.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about this. You're looking at what is so amazing. Kathleen alluded to this. Here you have this humongous fight over health care, over what is essentially, look at this, $1 trillion. And they threw $1 trillion around here without giving it a second thought.
Mm.
And, you know, it really says something about the ethical culture in this country, in Washington.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Rich, for your call. Pat from Oconomowoc, and we have about a minute and a half left, everybody. Hi, Pat.
Hi, I'll make it quick. To me, you know, we're so surprised, but I think this speaks to a greater problem of just government ineptitude. I mean, when all this money was just being thrown out the door in this crisis, I think a lot of us said to ourselves, great, you know, where's this all going to end up? Yeah. I mean, you know, we look in the news this past week, we see $8 billion that went to Acorn in the stimulus bill. And this is why people are so skeptical that money that's being spent by the government isn't being spent for any good reason whatsoever. And I think we are out there marching in the streets. So I would disagree with that a little bit. But everybody's cynical, like the last caller said. And, you know, anytime we're talking about large sums of money, I think that should be a big red flag to all the Americans have seen the spending in the past, into the Bush term, into the Obama term, and all of this money that we now know was wasted, was corrupt, was going to foreign banks, you know, was going to AIG, is going to Acorn. It's just we need to take a step back and stop this spending, and I think that's what we've been seeing a little bit here with the health care debate as well, and make sure it's not wasted.
All right, Pat.
Excellent point, and in the process of in terms of the waste of money and the no accountability, he's absolutely right on that, and it's, of course, not a new problem. I think what struck us about this one, in terms of just the TARP bill, was it sort of just the brazenness of it, just in the amounts going out under this cloud that the country is going to implode unless we do this.
This and may have been one of the greatest myths perpetrated, that the seas were going to open up and the skies were going to fall, and our financial world would collapse totally if we didn't do this.
It would really be interesting to go back and look at this also maybe 2 or 3 years from now.
Yeah,
after
please
all of the dust is finally settled.
You're the guys to do it. Thank
and
you.
It may look worse.
Thank you so much for being with us and for all of your work. You're the best. Thank
Always
you.
Always great to be with you, Kathleen.
Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Thank you. James Till and Donald Bartlett, their latest article, Good Billions After Bad, The Bailout 9. It's in the October issue of Vanity Fair. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your erudite calls. News is coming up. Open line for September following the news.